Siding Unlimited, named the best window installers, not just here, but in the whole USA. Get the best. Siding Unlimited, 5-time winner as America's best window installer. For windows you call Siding Unlimited, first and directly, SidingUnlimited.com.
Live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios in downtown Milwaukee, it's Wisconsin's Midday News, making stories come to life. Now, here are your hosts, Greg Matzik and Jessica Todd.
Well, lots to get to here in hour number two of the program, including a conversation with Brad Garrett. They're finding more information on this jewelry heist at the Louvre. I don't know why it makes me kind of snicker. It's just like, I don't know, I envision this place being heavily secure, and the idea that you could just walk away with, you know, millions and millions of dollars worth of jewels at a place like that, it seems far-fetched. It also seems likely very well coordinated. There is some new evidence and stuff we'll be diving into with Brad Garrett, but it's a fascinating story, one of many right now happening in the world.
I was stunned to find out the numerous places where the Louvre does not have security cameras. That was mind-boggling to me. You just think they'd be in every hall and every corner just about. I mean, when you have the crown jewels.
Yes, and there's like millions of people that walk through that place in a given year, right? And thousands per day. So we'll dive into the latest with Brad, see if they're on track here to catching who was ever involved. 109 here on WTMJ.
And now it's time for three big things on Wisconsin's Midday News.
Number one, a shocking NBA gambling scandal. Dozens of people, including current and former NBA players and coaches, have been arrested in connection with two separate gambling probes. One involves sports betting, the other, poker. Damon Jones, who had two quick stints with the Milwaukee Bucks, is among the defendants. So is Portland Trail Blazers coach Chauncey Billups and current Heat guard Terry Rozier. The interim U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of New York says in one scheme, the defendants would lure victims into rigged poker games for a chance to play with sports celebrities.
The scheme targeted victims known as, quote, fish, who were often lured to participate in these rigged games by the chance to play alongside former professional athletes who were known as, quote, face cards.
Investigators say the operations were supported by mafia crime families. Victims lost tens of millions of dollars.
Once the game was underway, the defendants fleeced the victims out of tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars per game. The defendants used a variety of very sophisticated cheating technologies, some of which were provided by other defendants in exchange for a share of the profits from the scheme.
In the other case, investigators say the defendants used insider information to place bets and altered their performance in games to maximize their payouts. This was a multi-year investigation going back to 2022.
Yeah, that's the Terry Rozier component to this. So he's a point guard in the NBA playing for the Charlotte Hornets. And sportsbooks started to notice a surge of betting on Terry Rozier.
I mean, it's kind of an obscure player,
right? I mean, it's not like everybody knows Giannis. Everybody knows Victor Wembanyama and some other stars. Everybody knows LeBron. Not everybody knows Terry Rozier. So to see a flurry of bets on the under in terms of points and rebounds and all that kind of stuff, prop bets they call that, mysteriously, he had a foot injury halfway through the game for the Charlotte Hornets in 2023. All those bets came in the day of that game, and it was flagged by sportsbooks. In fact, they took Terry Rozier out of all their props for the remaining portion of that year. So his stuff goes back to at least 2023.
And the investigators do not believe that the sports books had any idea about this, that they were involved in any capacity. But yeah, what they were seeing was a red flag.
A constant stream of dump trucks rolling into the White House grounds today. Demolition of the East Wing continues.
As backhoes tear down the more than 120-year-old structure, President Trump previously pledged the construction wouldn't touch the existing building.
It won't interfere with the current building. It won't be. It'll be near it, but not touching it. And pays total respect to the existing building, which I'm the biggest fan of.
But now he says the East Wing had to go.
It's ABC's Mary Bruce. A little perspective here. The White House is a 55,000 square foot building. The ballroom itself is 90,000 square feet, or it's expected to be upon completion.
Lots of dancing can happen in there.
That's big. Trump now says the cost of adding that massive ballroom to the White House has jumped to about $300 million. All the money will come from private donations, though The president says he may use the $230 million he's demanding from the Justice Department over the federal investigations he's faced. National Trust for Historic Preservation is calling for an immediate pause on construction until a legally required public review process can be completed.
Not big, Greg. Huge.
Yeah, it's massive. 90,000 square feet, anything is huge.
Number three, Cybertruck recall. Tens of thousands of Tesla Cybertrucks are being recalled because onboard software could inadvertently increase the intensity of the front parking lights. That would make their headlights brighter than federal standards allow. CBS's Christopher Cruz has the details.
The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration says Tesla isn't aware of any collisions, injuries, or fatalities caused by the headlights, but they could cause a distraction to other drivers and increase the risk of a crash. The company is recalling more than 63,000 Cybertrucks in the U.S. that were manufactured between November 13, 2023 and October 11, 2025. Owners don't have to do anything. Tesla will deliver a free software update over the air to correct the issue. Christopher Cruz, CBS News, Washington.
This isn't the first time this year Cybertrucks have been recalled. Back in March, federal safety regulators recalled more than 46,000 of the futuristic-looking vehicles, warning that an exterior panel that runs along the side of the windshield could detach while driving. That's never good.
114 on WTMJ, the latest on the Louvre heist with Brad Garrett after this. Still no sign of people responsible for stealing more than $100 million of crown jewels from the Louvre in Paris, but French authorities believe they are tracking on DNA evidence. Well, no evidence of George Clooney or Brad Pitt, but we do have ABC's crime and terrorism expert, Brad Garrett. Brad, what a brazen attempt to steal more than $100 million worth of crown jewels. A very coordinated attempt. And the question is just how many people were involved in this?
This took a lot of planning and organization. This also required, I believe, inside information of how the Louvre operates. The security, I'm going to guess, is not armed. That cameras that or camera that should have been seen by security showing this lorry, in other words, this vehicle that's got an electric ladder, basically, that are quite common in Paris. So to see one wouldn't make anybody suspicious, would have captured these guys, put in a ladder up and working on the window. Somebody had turned that camera around. And so obviously suspicious. So I guess what I'm saying is between their ability to control the scene once they get inside the Louvre, even though security is confronting them, they must have known that security's primary concern, and rightly so, is the safety of the patrons. And so they're basically herding people out of this wing of the Louvre as these guys are committing the robbery. And let's face it, that only took maybe a couple of minutes, maybe three, to get into two glass cabinets, steal something they could easily stick in a knapsack, and off they go. Now, it all seemed to be going together well until they get back down the ladder and are about to set the truck on fire for the obvious of what you just mentioned, the ability to maybe identify them. They got interrupted, I think, by security, and then they knew they were out of time. And so they hop on, the four of them, on two Yamaha motor scooters, and off they go. And I also think that this is beyond these four. I mean, a robbery like this that would take the planning and also to have people at the other end of this. In other words, jewelers that could basically take all the stones out of these various things they had stolen and then melt down the metal that they are used to hold it together and create new jewelry, because that's where this is going. You know, the robbers would have been paid whatever they were paid. And then beyond that, the people who maybe backed this, organized it, whatever, will then, you know, make a lot of money off the new jewelry that's created.
Brad, given how fast this was, 7 minutes in and out, how likely are police to track these guys or these men and women down, and what tools will they rely on the most?
Okay, so I think they will track them down. You know, big liability for them, the truck wasn't burned. Now they have DNA to at least one of them, and maybe more. We just don't know the answer to that. Because there's so many moving parts to commit these types of robberies. Many of the things the three of us have mentioned about inside information, about stealing the vehicle. They had to steal that lorry someplace. Cameras throughout Paris that may have caught them on these motor scooters going whatever direction they may have gone. To all the people involved in who are going to break down the jewelry, turn it into, you know, other types of something you wouldn't be able to probably ascertain that it came from this robbery.
Sure.
It's a lot of moving parts. It's a lot of people involved. If there's an inside job aspect of this, it's another liability that could upend the whole thing. And that's what typically happens in these sophisticated heists, is that it takes more than just you and somebody else doing it. It takes a lot. And so we'll see. But, you know, will they get this these precious items stolen back? I think I'd be largely surprised if that happens. But catching the people that, or at least some of the people involved, I think is probably doable.
I would have to imagine that security inside the Louvre is pretty robust for preventing such things, right? I mean, were there security cameras that were all of a sudden out of service and maybe during the portion of time where the jewels were ultimately heisted? You can start internally here, can't you, Brad? Isn't that the most logical place to start?
Oh, you're right, but you're doing all these things simultaneously at the same time. I call working cases like this a wheel, where you have all these spokes coming off the wheel. So simultaneously, investigators are, yes, dealing with inside the Louvre. Others are dealing with the evidence. Others are dealing with, you know, who's out on parole that's committed these type of heists in the past. Who may have planned this based on intel that they have through informants. You know, it just goes on and on and on. I will say this. I think the Louvre, like a lot of places you would think, would have the highest in security. It just doesn't. And in fact, the woman who runs it, who tried to quit and they wouldn't let her, you know, when she took over the Louvre, she was appalled about how bad it was. And she has improved it. But we all know you can only improve things based on the money you have to make the improvements.
Right.
And I don't think that's ever been there. And so she's done whatever she could do. Now my guess is she's going to need a lot more money. They're going to have, you know, robust cameras. They should have cameras on, you know, that literally aren't on the Louvre, but maybe across the street. She even wants a police substation, and she should have that. I mean, 30,000 people a day go to the Louvre, 9 million a year. So, you know, it's an astronomical number. And so the ability to sort of scope out what happens in those places would obviously be easy to do. But that inside information I'm talking about, cameras and alarms and all that stuff, and what the security guards would particularly do, all that stuff you had to get from somebody.
Brad, you used to be a FBI agent. Can we jump into the criminal psychology of this for a moment? Because to me, it's just fascinating. Like, what drives mm-hmm. people to attempt something this risky? Is it just the money they're going to get from these jewels? Is it thrill-seeking? Is it ego? Is it all of that, a mix?
It's a combination. I mean, let's face it, you know, everyone would like to be a race car driver, right? The thrill of doing that.
I don't know. That makes me a little nervous, but okay.
Well, anyway, but few of us ever do anything like that. The idea of the risk, the thrill, and the payoff all sort of intertwine that you can, you know, there's a certain personality of bad guys and gals that are willing to do these kind of things. I'll be surprised at the end of the day that if not one or more of these people involved in this have been involved in some version of this previously.
Yeah.
So we'll see where that goes. But yeah, I mean, it's and those of us out here watching this, you know, it's just you get these kinds of stories attract, I think, the general person because they are so bizarre, they are so high risk, they're so dangerous. And high adrenaline driven, you're on the clock, that we as the viewer of, let's say, a movie like Ocean's 11 or Heat, get lost in the characters. And I think that's what happens when the real thing happens, that people are so intrigued. And, you know, there's a fascination with, I think, with being able to safely watch people break the law in a very dangerous way. So you can sort of vicariously live through them, but you're obviously, you know, in your lounger chair in your living room while you're doing it.
It also requires a remarkable level of intelligence and coordinated movements and sophistication. I think that's part of the fascination. Typically, I mean, looking at something like this, $100 million worth of crown jewels, not a bunch of idiots, right? I mean, criminals, and they've broken the law, done the wrong thing.
Right.
But very, very well coordinated, it would appear. We'll see what French authorities come up as they track down DNA evidence. ABC's crime and terrorism expert Brad Garrett. Interesting stuff, Brad. We appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks, Brad.
You're welcome. Take care, guys.
Well, the good news is, should see some sun on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Temperatures in the 50s. The bad news is, you might have a very crispy lawn to walk through if you're going out to get the mail tomorrow morning or let the dog out. A freeze warning goes into effect at 2 o'clock tomorrow morning, and I guess bring those peppers in if you have some outside on your patio.
I think I need to stop at the grocery store on the way home tonight and pick up an onion because I need to make some more hot sauce. That's
okay.
What I do with the habaneros. I make a hot sauce with it. So it's time. Those peppers have to come off.
Well, you'll be doing that. I'll be getting a new winter hat. We welcome in Brian Nisnansky, TMJ4 Chief Meteorologist. Hey, Niz.
I like that idea with the peppers. I have a huge pepper crop this year.
Ooh.
Like they're still going strong right now. And I'm you know when you're giving them to people and they're like, please stop. You know, like they don't want to be mean. They're like, oh, I don't want your pepper. You know, I just have a bumper crop of peppers. So
well, what
yeah,
kind
that
of peppers?
Good. Make a little jalapeno.
Ooh,
so
yeah.
there's quite a bit of spice to them. Really, actually, it depends. It varies. It's kind of interesting. One, I'll you know, eat fresh. I'll slice it up, put it on a taco or something, and it's not bad. And then all of a sudden, you'll get one that's just like, whoa, yeah, that's got some heat to it. But I don't know what it was. It was easily my best crop that I had in the garden this year.
Do you ever let them go red and then kind of get the veins? Sometimes people think like, oh, they're not good at that point, but I feel like they're just spicier.
Yeah, I do. Not necessarily on purpose, but there are a few that, you know, either you miss that are hanging on the vine and stuff like that or on the limb. And yeah, no, it's great. I mean, it adds color to whatever you're trying to make too or whatever you're adding it to. So
I might have to hit you up for some jalapenos because my jalapeno plant didn't do as well, but my habanero plant was just bursting. I mean, I have like one plant. I've got 40 habanero peppers.
Oh, jeez.
I don't need as many jalapenos for the hot sauce, but it's so much easier to use jalapenos. You can throw them on just about anything, right? Throw
they're
them on
more
pizza,
tolerable,
on
too.
Tacos. The habaneros, it's different, and that's why I started making the hot sauce, because all of a sudden I grew them and thought, now what do I do with them?
Niz, you strike me as more of a shishito guy, but that's just me. I don't know.
I do like a good shishito pepper. Totally am there. But I'm spicy. I don't like something that completely overpowers what I'm trying to eat, but I like some good heat to my food. But whether it's peppers, tomatoes, you name it, any annual flowers that you got going on, I would cover them up tonight. This is going to be easily our coldest night of the season so far. I anticipate most locations away from the lake dipping below freezing, maybe even some 20s in some spots. If you are within a couple miles of the lake shore, there is a chance that maybe you hover just above the freezing mark, but you're probably still going to have some frost as well. There's enough of a breeze out of the west that's going to really offset any true warming near Lake Michigan. So tonight, I think it's a safe bet for everybody. If you want to keep anything going, cover it up or bring them in.
All right, Niz, that's for tonight. As we look ahead to the weekend here, beginning tomorrow, it looks like the sun does come back. So I guess that's the good news, right? Frost tonight, potentially bringing the plants, but put them back out for tomorrow and the rest of the weekend at least.
Yeah, weekend looks good, including tomorrow looks good. There's going to be some rain chances that start to creep in here early next week, but I do think we get through the weekend dry. Mix of clouds and sunshine. There'll be some intervals of clouds, but still plenty of sunshine to go around. It's not going to be like the summer weather we had a weekend ago, but definitely a weekend or two ago. But definitely very fall-like. Comfortable outside. We're talking 50s, might even push 60 degrees, especially on Sunday. It should be good. And that's a great recipe for bright colors on the trees, not muted colors on the trees. You want these cool, frosty mornings and warm sunshine in the afternoon, topping around 60 degrees. So we got a couple good things going for us.
That's great. And what about for the trick-or-treaters? Because we have people going trick-or-treating this weekend and next weekend in our communities.
Yeah. Us too. Grafton Saturday night. I know the neighborhood's already getting their plans going. I think it's a great evening that you would expect for Halloween, like that very nice, like storybook Halloween, where you have a fire going, you need your shacket or your fleece, a hat on. All the fall feels look good. It will get a little bit chilly, especially, you know, when the sun goes down, but tolerable for kids to actually, you know, enjoy and wear their costumes. Now, sure, if they have a costume that isn't very warm, maybe after the trick-or-treat, they're going to want to bundle up. But we're not talking like mandatory winter coats over your Elsa costume.
Good. That's always such a bummer for the kids and the parents.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's tough for photos outside when they're just kind of shivering in cold. But
it is. Life. Yeah. That's happened. I mean, it's been, I think, 2023, I want to say. So 2 years ago, we had at least a few inches of snow on actual Halloween. And obviously, there was trick-or-treating then. And then I believe it was 3 years prior to that, we had 5 inches of snow. So we've had a couple snowy Halloweens. And thankfully, this early trick-or-treat this weekend definitely looks snow-free. And in the long term, I think as we get into next weekend for actual Halloween, which I believe is Friday next week, it looks good too.
Good stuff, Niz. We'll check it again tomorrow.
Thanks so much.
Okay, guys. Yep, we'll see you.
1:44, our weekly wellness check with Dr. Ben Weston after this.
Doctor, doctor, give me the news. I got a bad case of loving you.
Time to check in with our doctor on record here at Wisconsin's Midday News, our weekly wellness check with Dr. Ben Weston, Chief Health Policy Advisor for Milwaukee County, Associate Professor of Emergency Medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin. Hey, Dr. Weston.
Good afternoon.
Dr. Weston, I was watching football a couple weeks back, and I noticed that retired NFL star Deion Sanders, now a collegiate coach, has a portable toilet on the sidelines this season after having bladder cancer. And all of a sudden, I just started Googling more about bladder cancer because I was curious about this tent that he has on the sidelines and, you know, why exactly he needs it and all that sort of thing. So it made me realize that there are probably more people who don't know all the ins and outs of bladder cancer. So for our listeners who are hearing about bladder cancer for the first time, what exactly is it? Who's at highest risk and what early warning signs should not be ignored?
Yeah, we don't hear about it that much, but it's actually one of the more common cancers, particularly in men and especially those over 55. So to put a number to it, there'll be 85,000 new cases of bladder cancer expected this year. Now, what are the risk factors? The most significant ones, certainly smoking, that's a risk factor for just about any cancer. Also, chemical exposures from certain jobs, manufacturing, painting, some chemicals make you more prone, and then family and personal history. Now, the things to watch for, probably the number one thing is blood in your urine. Now, there's a lot of causes for it. It can be red, pink, even Coca-Cola colored. But if you have blood in your urine, that's not something you want to ignore. You want to get it checked out, figure out what the cause is and how best to address it.
Dr. Weston, is there a screening opportunity for bladder cancer similar to those that we hear about with breast cancer or colon cancer?
Yeah, so chances are that would be just a urine sample. Now, after you give that urine sample, kind of what happens next depends on the results. If you have concerning results, if you're having persistent blood in your urine, you might get a cystoscopy. This is where a little camera is inserted in your bladder to kind of look at the lining and potentially take some samples, and then potentially some imaging to help determine what exactly is going on. So it is a stepwise process, but it usually starts with just a simple urine sample.
This might sound like a weird question, but this is really what got me kind of thinking more about bladder cancer, because I was looking into this tent that's on the sidelines for Deion Sanders. Why would he need that tent? Can you explain that?
Yeah, so it has to do with how the treatment works. And so first you want to figure out what exactly is going on with that cancer. So you have to stage it, and that's to figure out how far along the cancer is. Has it spread to other areas? You want to grade it. And so when we hear about grade of cancer, that's about how aggressive the cancer is. Now, depending on what those results may be, it might be treatment with chemotherapy, it might be treatment with something localized, or it might actually be removal of the bladder. And so when you have removal of the bladder, you just can't store urine the way that you're used to, where you can wait hours and hours between going. You might have to go a lot more frequently. You might have more urgency. And so having something like that available so you're not running through the whole stadium is going to make a big difference.
Let's talk about treatment options and quality of life. What does that look like?
Yeah, so as with any cancer, it's an important conversation to have. Is the treatment chemotherapy? Is the treatment radiation? Is the treatment surgery? And how will that affect your quality of life? And so that's why it's so important to understand what kind of cancer you have, has it spread, how aggressive is it, and what that really means. Some cancers, you think of prostate cancer, as you get older, you might die of other causes before that prostate cancer is going to get you. And so you may not want to aggressively treat it. But of course, these are conversations to have with your doctor, with your oncologist, to decide what is going to be the best treatment, the best path forward for you.
Dr. Weston, on Monday, we were talking about this protein craze and how you can go to the grocery store and it seems like everything these days will say high protein or protein this. They're focusing on that. And one of the things I was asking your expert at that time was, I was like, hey, wasn't there just a Consumer Reports study that found more than two-thirds of popular protein powders and shakes contained measurable levels of lead? And indeed, there was. The FDA also just expanded recalls on several brands of ground cinnamon for the same reason. So with supplements and everyday spices under review, experts say these findings highlight the importance of product testing, food safety oversight, and really staying informed about what is in what we are consuming every day. What's behind the recent reports?
Yeah, so both these reports really point to the same issue, which is trace contamination. So pretty low levels, but still they're there from the environment. So it's important to remember lead is a naturally occurring metal. It's in the soil, it's in the water, and so plants absorb that. And so especially when you have these plant-based protein powders, they may test higher for lead than other types of protein powders. Now, the good news is the amounts typically aren't at a high enough level to cause harm, especially for healthy adults. The concern is more about chronic exposure, but in the end, it's exactly what you said. It's about awareness, buying from reputable brands, understanding the importance of federal regulatory bodies. They're here for a reason. And this is one great example to make sure certain chemical levels in our food is not too high. So it's about awareness and it's about moderation, but especially about going with reputable brands, reputable products.
Dr. Weston, are there parts of the body that would react more sensitively to lead exposure, just more vulnerable than other parts?
Yeah, absolutely. So lead builds up slowly in the body. But it's exposure over time that can affect our organs. Now, almost every organ can be affected, but the brain and the nervous system in general are certainly the most vulnerable. In adults, chronic exposure causes things like fatigue, headaches, blood pressure issues, kidney issues. But in children, we hear about this with lead paint, with lead pipes and water. It's more serious. Even small amounts can really impact and delay learning, as well as growth, as well as affect behavior. Now, the tricky part here is that symptoms are often subtle and they can be delayed, which is why prevention and awareness is so critical and so important.
Exactly. So what can we do to lower our risk of lead exposure?
Yeah, so the first thing is, especially when we're talking about products we're eating, choose wisely. Look for products that are third-party certified. There's a few different organizations out there, but these are independently tested for these sort of contaminants. Also, stay informed. You can check the FDA, look for recall alerts, especially around things like spices and supplements. And if there's a recall, obviously get rid of the product. And then eat for protection. So what does this mean? It means a very nutrient-rich diet. There are certain things, calcium, iron, vitamin C. These can actually block lead absorption in the body. So just another reason to have a varied, healthy diet, including fruits and vegetables.
Hey, Dr. Weston, before we let you go, real quick, I saw a study published earlier this week, in about 60,000 children who avoided developing peanut allergies following guidelines that go back about a decade that actually encouraged feeding babies peanut products starting about 4 months old. If you want to avoid the allergy, hey, feed your kids peanuts and related items, peanut butter Captain Crunch, whatever it may be. And now it sounds like this study is starting to show some positive results.
Yeah, so the guidance here has really changed. This all started actually back in 2015. There's a study called the LEAP study. You can look it up, but it flipped decades of medical advice. For years, parents were told delay feeding children peanuts. But what this trial showed was actually the opposite. So if you introduce peanut products as early as 4 months old, you can reduce the risk of developing peanut allergy by more than 80%. So really major results here. And follow-up studies have shown that protection lasts into adolescence, even after the kids stop eating peanuts regularly. So it's a simple early step that's already prevented thousands of kids from developing these really not only inconvenient, but potentially life-threatening allergies.
So what is the safest way to introduce peanut products to young kids?
Yeah, so a peanut allergy, it's important to remember, it's caused by the body's immune system seeing the protein in peanuts as harmful. And that gives a reaction, allergic symptoms, sometimes life-threatening anaphylaxis, these allergy emergencies. But introducing a food like peanuts early, we're basically training the immune system to recognize it as harmless. So there's not that sort of reaction. Now, certainly talk to your doctor about this. But for most babies, the general guidance is that introducing peanuts can be done safely at home, around 4 to 6 months old, with small amounts of smooth peanut butter mixed into, you know, the pureed fruits and oatmeal that you're typically giving. The key really is early careful exposure in small, consistent amounts. But like any sort of medical issues here, you want to talk to your pediatrician, your family doctor, and have a plan in place here.
Always great information. Dr. Ben Weston joining us, the Medical College of Wisconsin, our weekly wellness check.